Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
Hello, I'm Sean Dunderdale. I'm the new robot presenter of the farming program as we're discussing robotics and the effect they're having on the world of agriculture.
Whoa, hang on. Robots might be taking over farming, but it's not taking over this program just yet. Yes, we are talking robots this morning, but are they really the future for agriculture?
The technology, without doubt, is there. You know, there is the machine that can pick a strawberry, but the human hand is still proving more efficient.
Also this week, neonics and glyphosate, with 8 months to go before the latter could be banned. Plus, Chris Spratt has your grain report this week. Busy week, Chris?
Well, I suppose political influences continue. The announcement on Tuesday of the general election on the 8th of June. So we're now joining France, Italy and Germany in voting for the new governments over the next few months. So we are unified in some way, Sean.
Indeed. Yeah. More from Chris in a short while.
The Week in Agriculture. This is the Farming Programme with Sean Dunderdale.
Hello, I am here, not a robot, just yet, give it time. In 8 months' time, you heard me right, glyphosate use could be no more. It's certainly causing concern for those in farming. The loss of neonics is also a cause for concern, and a meeting was held this week in Cambridge with various industry leaders in attendance. Our agronomist Sean Sparling was part of that meeting. He's on a steering group looking at the issue. He's also, I think I'm right, Sean, producing a report due out soon on glyphosate. Is that right?
Yes, morning, Sean. There's an awful lot going on behind the scenes in UK agriculture that people may not be aware of. Obviously, glyphosate we're aware of, and I can't go into details, but a report will be produced next week, largely detailing the possible effects of a ban on UK agriculture and the wider economy. But what I want to just mention is something people may not know about, and that is there are new European Commission proposals that threaten our cereal and sugar beet seed dressings as well in the UK. We use seed dressings as a very, very targeted way of dealing with a problem, particularly insect pests. It's precision farming at its best because it's right down to seed level, and it enables us to put an insecticide on a seed that is purely contained within that plant, so only the pests we're after are affected, and we protect the beneficials to a much wider extent than we ever can by applying insecticides. Now, in March, the European Commission submitted new proposals to a standing committee of member states to ban all outdoor use of neonicotinoid seed dressings in non-bee attractive crops like wheat, barley and sugar beet. Now, in the explanation, the Commission based all their proposals on a bee guidance document, which had not even been ratified by the member states, produced by activists, not even been ratified by the member state. Now, these proposals will be discussed during the next standing committee, which is scheduled for around the 17th, 18th of May 2017. And normally they would be discussed at great length, but the Commission has also included in the proposals the possibility of a rapid phase out to come into force next year. So the decision to table those proposals was made without any consideration whatsoever of the impact that ban might have on a UK or European farmer's ability to grow a high-quality, affordable crop of wheat, barley, sugar beet. And we're all very, very concerned about bee health. I'm on record as saying that. The whole industry is concerned about bee health. But to propose a ban based on concerns for bees and pollinators, it's absolutely bizarre because bees don't even forage or even visit cereals or sugar beet on a regular basis. So we use a product, Deter, which is clothianidin, and that's used as a seed treatment in wheat and barley, mostly to control aphids, which is the major carrier of BYDV and CYDV. And without the seed treatment, we would probably need to spray an extra one or two times with a broad spectrum insecticide. Now, since farmers used DETERF for aphid control and BYDV on an area of about 2.5 million acres across the UK, that means 2.5 million acres would receive another insecticide spray that it doesn't get today because of that targeted precision use of the seed dressing. That's an area about half the size of Wales. And in addition to that, that will use an extra 220,000 litres of diesel. That's 200 million litres of water, roughly. It's an extraordinary situation that we're finding ourselves in here. Now, also, of course, DETERF is used to deter slug attack on the seeds, as much as it is for its insecticidal activity. And if you don't use that seed dressing, that means we'll be using about 1,600 tonnes more slug pellets. That just seems ridiculous for something that is inherently safe to bees, which is the whole point of which they're trying to get it removed. Now, you move on to sugar beet, we use Poncho Beta and Cruiser, and that is a real difficult issue for us because there's no alternative spray to control the most important aphids, Mysis persici, that carry beet virus yellows, and it may be impossible to control that virus in the absence of an effective seed treatment. So the situation needs to be explained to the politicians in Brussels, in Westminster, and even the devolved parliament, Scotland, Ireland, Wales. These people are the ones who will make that decision about the use of these seed treatments. So I would urge you to write a letter or email your local MP, the MEPs in your area. They need to hear about what impact that ban will have on your ability to continue with your economical business. Why do you use these products? What do you do if they're not available? Would you have to spray more often, use more slug pellets, etc., etc.? And what about negative effects? Explain what you think about the Commission making these proposals without even checking what impact they could have on growing cereals or beet in your area.
Sean Sparling and the possible loss of neonics. We'll hear more from Sean with his regular agronomy report later in the programme. Last week, we discussed lambing and the number of triplets being born to ewes this year. Well, despite that, finding British lamb in the supermarkets over the Easter weekend seemed to become the new Easter egg hunt. In fact, there was more chance of finding Easter eggs. Why are supermarkets so keen on New Zealand lamb? And what needs to be done to change their attitude? James Seeley is auctioneer at Newark Livestock Market, and he's raised the issue once or twice before.
Really, it's one of my biggest bugbears. At the moment, I mean, we see it particularly through social media of late. You know, all these supermarkets bang the drum about how proud they are to back British farmers, etc., etc. And consistently, we've seen over the Easter period, you know, like you say, a massive stock of New Zealand and Australian lamb. I mean, the Saturday before Easter, through Newark, I sold 5,000 head of hogs or sort of old season lambs. Now for any supermarket to be saying to us that there's a lack of supply and quality of British lamb for them to be stacking, you know, I think is shocking.
Is it down to price, do you think?
Yeah, I think it's down to price to some degree, but also I think it's down perhaps to us as an industry and particularly some of the levy bodies and organisations that we are members or farmers are members to, not promoting and not engaging with the general public. I think the supermarkets are to blame. I think that, you know, some advertising and labelling of lamb has been very discriminatory to the British lamb. And I think that the consumer who thinks that they're backing British by shopping and picking a piece of lamb or a leg of lamb or, you know, whatever chops up from underneath a British flag, perhaps don't necessarily look because automatically they assume that that's what it is. But yeah, definitely a very big bugbear of mine at the minute.
When you say discriminatory, in what way?
Well, I mean, you know, we as a British industry and as the British farmers pride ourselves on a product and grass reared to high welfare standards anywhere, and probably the highest across, you know, Europe certainly, and if not the world, and that the farmer isn't being backed by the hand it's being fed by, I suppose.
And as you mentioned there, you know, certain products are, they've got the British flag on, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's British lamb, does it?
No, it doesn't. And, you know, also we've seen various supermarkets going through the mill of late where, you know, they've been producing a product saying it's from X farm, Y farm and every other farm when actually, it you know, it's coming out of New Zealand and being processed as wild farm lamb and promoted as sort of a British product, which has absolutely got no British origin at all.
Now, I know you had a bit of a tussle with one particular supermarket probably around this time last year. Do you think the supermarkets are taking note? Are they listening at all? It doesn't seem to be the case, does it?
No, I think, you know, I've had it massively with one major retailer to which I've actually still had no answer to, you know, how in April and May they can't be solely stacking or promoting British lamb, and all they say to me is, well, you can get it on the fresh meat counter. Well, actually, how many people go into a supermarket to buy fresh meat from a counter? They just go and pick up a packed leg, and they can't get a product which is in prime in season. So I think, you know, all we seem to be getting, and you know, you can look on my social media feed, you can look on several sort of farmers and auctioneers up and down through the country, and all we seem to get is a standard reply from whatever supermarket it is or whoever they delegate to reply to them saying, we do source during prime time season and it's all to do with lack of supply. Well, like I say, you know, new at last Saturday, 5,000 lambs with one of 130 or 40 livestock markets through the country that are selling on average, let's say, 1,000 head a week across a market. There's 150,000 head of sheep being sold per week live, let alone what's going through, you know, butchers, wholesalers and abattoirs on a deadweight basis. So how at this time of year they can be saying it's down to a lack of supply is just a non-argument, really. We, as an industry in terms of agriculture, are going to go through a fairly turbulent time with everything that's going on with Brexit, uncertainty over subsidies, etc., etc. And I think what we actually need to do is re-engage with our general public and be saying to them, look, you know, you have got the opportunity to be purchasing a product which has got the highest welfare standards in the world, is grass-fed or grass-reared, is a prime product, and actually pence per kilo, it's no less than what you're having as an imported product. So why don't you back your own farmers and suppliers rather than, you know, put money into the supermarket pocket?
James Seeley, auctioneer at New York Livestock Market, supporting, no surprise, British lamb. At the start of the programme, we briefly heard from Chris Spratt at Open Field and mention of that snap election caused by Theresa May. As you said, Chris, there was quite a speedy response to that announcement, wasn't there?
I think we saw a pretty much an immediate reaction on the day, with sterling firming and markets taking a hit of £1.50 to £2 down on London wheat futures. But towards the end of the week, as the markets absorbed the fact, values recovered to almost unchanged. But sterling's firmness does, as we know, hinder any price rally on the grain markets, and it makes old crop imports look potentially more attractive to consumers. That's providing, of course, they can find the source, organise the logistics and finance the trade to buy in the volume that's needed to get the price. I think over the next week or two, we may well start to see the relationship between the futures market, which I know a lot of our growers watch, and the physical market start to move as we get into May. There's still a large open position on futures to square off. Generally, old crop wheat prices remained underpinned by the tight S&D, but capped by the proximity to imported wheat and maize prices. Latest stats indicate that 1.3 million tonnes of wheat will have left the UK by the end of March. So in actual fact, that's a pretty good effort, really, given the figures we started with. So the timing of harvest and the availability of other grains will be key on paper, at least to the UK going into harvest on bare boards, if the numbers are correct. So, you know, last year, Sean, we were here and we'd got a carry from old crop prices into new crop. This year, we've got a £15 to £20 discount to new crop, so no consumer's going to want to carry wheat through at the moment. Milling wheat premiums were there, poor to non-existent, and that's also reflecting in the poor take-off of existing contracts, with many mills dragging their heels on wheat that's been sold to them for April, in actual fact. New crop wheat prices, well, they have found little support recently from the tight old crop scenario. And you know, even 4 months out, it might well be that there'll be some willing buyers for that first cut wheat, really. The key to new crop price structure going forward, I think, will be the size and quality of the harvest, again, as it was last year. An average yield will lead the UK with a small exportable surplus without the buffer of the large carry-in that we had last year, which won't need to be sold or discounted to clear the decks. Alternatively, you know, if we see the yields that we had in 2015, the market will need to realign itself more to reflect export parity, certainly in the first part of the season. Old crop feed barley, well, that's still trading in the low 120s ex-farm, with new crop feed barley trading at similar discounts to this season, around about £20. And that's on the ideas, really, of larger exportable surplus on the barley with a finite demand domestically, which will have to compete with other origins on the international export market, as it has done occasionally this season. UK prices, well, we know they've benefited from sterling weakness post-Brexit. That, obviously, looking at some of the scenarios we're faced with at the moment, can't be relied on going forward. So, you know, a lot of growers have already taken the opportunity and priced a reasonable percentage of their new crop at around about the sort of levels we're at the moment. And I think that's probably prudent advice at the moment. All the trade and growers obviously still weather watching. We're dry in certain parts of Europe, most definitely, and the UK in parts is getting that way. Rains in Argentina, late plantings of the US maize crop and spring wheat, and the El Nino concerns for later summer and early autumn are all issues that we need to keep an eye on over the next few months. As we've said, many parts of the UK need rain. France, in a similar sort of situation to where they were last year. They're growing concern that they don't see a repeat of last year's crop disaster. And as we know, Sean, weather reports indicating rain have a nasty habit of turning to dust, although I am away for a few days towards the end of next week, so that's usually a good indication we'll get a drop of rain. But I wouldn't plan my workload on my say-so anyway. And oilseed rape, generally a quiet week, little trade as the market adjusted to currency movement. And it's been frustrating, really, because buyers have been watching the French Matif futures market, lowering their ideas. Sellers want similar values to the day before, and the market's just stagnated, really. Little old crop to go for, but in actual fact, few sellers on the flip side. Quick look at prices. May feed wheat, 143 to 145, with harvest 130 to 133, and November 17, 133 to 136, with a pound a month carry. Feed barley for May, 118 to 120, with harvest nominally 105, and November, £113 ex-farm. Oilseed rape for May, 330x, with no harvest 290 to 295, and November, 300 to 305. Feed beans old crop 160 to 162, with November at 148. And finally, spring barley old crop trade sort of depleting now, really, about £140 for the best spring barleys at the moment, with a wide range for autumn 130 to 140. The market has actually improved on the back of dryness in Europe this week, but lost a similar sort of amount due to currency.
Thank you, Chris Spratt's Open Field. Last week, Matt Soanes was discussing Brexit with Holbeach flower grower Matthew Naylor during a visit with NFU Deputy President Minette Batters. Well, as part of that discussion, they got on to the future of the industry and robotics, another change that seems to be coming to many parts of farming, although Matthew Naylor doubts they'll ultimately replace much of what he does on his farm.
Anybody who's tried to change the clock on their microwave knows that technology can be a pain, even when it's mass-produced and in a domestic environment. So when you put it in the middle of a muddy field when it's raining, there's obviously challenges there. So we're going to try and do more to take the physical work out of what we do, and we've certainly been talking to Harper Adams University about introducing robotics, but I think that we're 5 years away from even seeing prototypes and 10 years away from seeing anything that will radically transform what we do here.
I'll pose sort of the same question to you, Minette. Are farmers willing to take the jump on robotics? You know, we see all these wonderful, you know, carrot picking machines or machines that can do X, Y, Z. But do farmers want to buy them? Do they see them as useful?
Farmers have embraced innovation and technology. I mean, we see in our dairy industry, we've got a lot of robotic milking going on. But I think there's a challenge here around cost. So a lettuce picker, for example, is way in excess of £1 million. We've not seen any price movement in fruit and veg in the last 15 years. So where is that investment going to come from? I think we're still incredibly reliant on the human hand, you know, for picking a strawberry, for cutting a flower. It's precision. And as Matt says, you know, the technology, without doubt, is there. You know, there is the machine that can pick a strawberry. But the human hand is still proving more efficient and, to a certain extent, a lot more reliable. And I think we'll get there with mechanisation and automation, but not for a long time. And it will need massive, massive investment.
And I would follow up by saying, as someone who, you know, we've lived in Lincolnshire for generations, we do care about this area. If I go and buy a Dutch machine for £1 million that replaces 50 workers, that's a bit of a mixed blessing for the local economy. I think the people who argue in favour of a completely mechanised world are not realising the impact that will have on society. And I really do like the fact that our business supports lots of families in the area, some admittedly migrants, some who have lived here and worked in the industry for generations, as I have. So I think it's a shame if we sort of disparage, you know, working in the fresh produce industry too much, because it's a loss of jobs that keep people in touch with nature and the things that matter, like food and fresh air that we depend upon.
Matthew Naylor and Manette Batters discussing robotics there. Our agronomist is thankfully still human. Let's return to Sean Sparling with his weekly agronomy report. Hello again, Sean.
Yes, hello again, Sean. I think what we can say with some confidence is what was forecasted to happen didn't, and then what forecasted to happen did. We were forecast to get some rain over the Easter weekend. All of us were hoping we were going to get half an inch or so, but we didn't. I have now taken 5 millimetres of rain through the entire month of April, and suffice to say, things are very, very dry and crops are incredibly stressed. And what a stressed crop brings with it is a very stressed farmer and an even more stressed agronomist. Now, there's nothing we can do about it unless you're fortunate enough to have an irrigation system on hand. But you need to bear in mind a couple of things. If you're going to irrigate spring wheat or spring barley and you're growing those crops to control blackgrass, if you've laid down a pre-emergence herbicide layer, you chucking half an inch of rain at it in a very short period of time may well wash that barrier away. And the only way that the pre-ems like flufenacet, for example, will degrade is under microbial activity, which is under wet activity. So the it's catch 22, this one. If you put water on a field, you make the crop grow and you'll be far more relaxed about that crop. But you may also make the blackgrass grow. And if you've washed that layer of residual herbicide away, you may well find the blackgrass grows just as quickly as the spring cereal. So it's a real trade-off. You need to discuss it. You know your fields better than I do. Pick your fields if you're going to do that. And just keep praying for rain. I'm going to have a barbecue this weekend. With a bit of luck, that'll bring it on, because it always does in any other year. But it is incredibly dry. There is a complication on sugar beet as well, because what we did get were the -2 frosts in the middle of the week. And when you've got a sugar beet crop, which is incredibly tender, poking through the ground, it's not quite at fully expanded cotyledons, you go putting a cocktail of herbicides on that with the adjuvants that come with them, the risk is incredibly high that you're going to burn off those cotyledons. And if there are no true leaf buds there, you're probably going to do some significant damage. So I've been advising my growers to stay out of their sugar beet this week, because we don't want to compromise it. Because the other factor is that whole stress thing. Stress, don't underestimate the effect stress will have on a crop, and in particular, how much that stress will cause extra crop damage from fertiliser or chemical scorch. BYDV in spring barley and spring wheat, you can find aphids quite easily. Rose grain aphid, grain aphid, bird cherry aphid. They're easy to find if you get on your hands and knees and get down at crop level and look into the sun. You can pick out the aphids sitting on the backs of the leaves. So kind of need to get out there and get some insecticide on, put some manganese with it, because that'll help the lipid or the wax on the leaves rebuild after these frosts. And just remember that with the frost that we had this week, you need to leave 4 or 5 days clear of those frosts before you go rolling, so that the plants have an opportunity to rebuild those wax layers, which is in essence what protects them. Cereals, winter wheat, winter barley, some of these have got the flag leaf out now. It'll only be a matter of a week or so before the awns are pricking out on the most forward pieces, so flag leaf timing is approaching. If you've got wild oats, you need to be on with that and you need to deal with them. Winter wheat is anything from growth stage 30 up to growth stage 35. Leaf 2 is emerging on some of these forward pieces of Skyfall in particular, but also KWS Lily and Siskin. They're all moving quite quickly now, and that's probably a stress reaction. You get a little drop of rain, they suck up the nitrogen. I think what's very clear in the field is where people are using urea, these crops are not responding to that urea as quickly as they are from ammonium nitrate, and that's only natural. Ammonium nitrate will sink into the soil. You can walk fields now that were spread with urea a week ago, and you could nearly pick up the prills and put them back in the bag. And the problem with urea is, as it gets warmer and you get dewy nights, you're going to get volatilisation, and it will go upwards rather than down into the crop. So you need to be aware of that and monitor these crops quite closely, because they may well need a little bit more nitrogen than you initially thought. The disease levels are relatively benign at the moment. Yellow rust is obviously perfect weather for rust. Cool and damp nights, that's perfect for rust. So don't drop your guard against rust. Remember, epoxyconazole, very, very good triazole against rust. Tebuconazole, also very good. Metconazole, very good. Prothioconazole, very good as a protectant, but not brilliant as an eradicant. So T1 fungicides are now really underway. I'm going with all of mine. I've said before, I would much rather be 5 days early than 5 days late. And you don't need that wet weather to spread Septoria around the canopy. They're full of them in the bottom, many of these fields. And even if it's like children with nits, we've said it before, the hair bashing about is enough to move Septoria around. So for goodness sake, respond to the issue. Don't just put it off and sit back and say, well, it's dry, so there's no pressure there from disease. There is a lot of pressure from disease, and as soon as these dewy nights are enough to make the problems worse. And as you drive around the county, you'll see fields which are a lot yellower than others. That's probably because of a delay in the T0 fungicide. So don't procrastinate, get on with it. Don't worry so much about the odd frost as long as your day temperatures are up. Things like Trinexapac ethyl, Modus will work in these conditions. You may be slightly down on the activity of a thing like Chlormaquat 3C or 5C, but you need to react to the crop. Don't just wait for leaves to emerge, because remember the filicron, they emerge under day degrees. Things are going to be quite slow for the next week or two. And if the forecasters are right, we're in for a lot more frosts and cold weather next week. So pick your days, get out there and do some good.
Sean Sparling of Sparling Agronomy Services. Well, as mentioned, there is talk of an Arctic blast heading our way this week. So is it scarves and long johns back out of the wardrobe?
The Farming Programme. 5 day forecast.
Not quite. It is going to be chillier. Today, possibility of a shower, patchy clouds, some sunny spells, highs of 13 Celsius, the wind from the west 15 miles an hour. Overnight, staying cloudy, should be dry, maybe some rain first thing tomorrow morning, but mostly dry, 7 Celsius the low, the wind from the west-southwest at 10, maybe gusting at 30 miles an hour in places. Tomorrow, patchy clouds, sunny spells, bit of rain in the morning as mentioned, 10 Celsius the high for Monday, the wind from the northwest 15 to 20 miles an hour. And that's when things start to change. Cold nights ahead, Monday into Tuesday, clear skies, could push temperatures down to 1, maybe 2 Celsius, certainly a frost first thing on Tuesday, the wind from the northwest 15 to 30 miles an hour. Tuesday itself, we'll see a few showers. We're looking at highs of around 8 Celsius, if we're lucky. The wind from the north, northwest, 20, gusting at 25 miles an hour. And then some late evening sunshine, clear skies. That means another cold night Tuesday into Wednesday. Freezing point could well be the low first thing on Wednesday morning. So again, a frost possible. The wind from the north, northwest, 15, gusting at 30 miles an hour. Some sunshine, but again, showers through the middle of the week on Wednesday, 7 Celsius at best. The wind from the north-northwest, 20-25 miles an hour. And then as we head towards the latter end of the week, there could be some particularly heavy rain coming for Thursday and Friday. That wind continuing to blow from the north, so that will keep temperatures just above freezing overnight. And at about 7, 8, maybe 9 Celsius come the end of the week during the day. Our hourly updates will, of course, keep you updated with that. That's the forecast then. It's Great British Beef Week this coming week, did you know? Good luck to the organisers, also Ladies in Beef, who are now hosting a lot of events across the country over the next few days. Some great beef recipes on their website as well. Well worth checking out. Whether it's beef, lambing, arable, whatever part of agriculture, have a good week's farming.